Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, some people said the Merced Rescue Mission's hot meals program wasn't a good neighbor. It was causing problems in the neighborhood. As of last night, it has a new home. We'll hear why it's so hard to find a place to serve those most in need. We'll also find out why the push for more mental health treatment facilities in Fresno can be a challenge. And stay with us, you won't want to miss the second episode of our new outdoors podcast that we appropriately call Outdoorsy. We'll go to Mono Hot Springs and talk about the best backpacking food that you've had. Right now, though, we turn our attention to one of the Valley's biggest industries, dairy. A few weeks ago, we told you about concerns within the dairy industry following the state's latest climate legislation. The new laws require livestock producers to cut methane emissions from manure by almost half by the year 2030. It seems like a tall task, but a kind of facility that's popular in Europe could help the California dairy industry meet those goals, if only it were easier to build here. FM 89's Carrie Klein brings us to Tulare County with more.
When it comes to how Governor Brown has affected the dairy industry, dairy producer Joey Arroso doesn't mince words.
He's making it difficult for us to be able to, you know, for anybody to produce anything in this state.
He's worried because in order to keep up with methane restrictions, dairy producers may have to overhaul their manure management systems or make expensive renovations that many can't afford.
He's going to put people out of business, a lot of them.
But there is a technology that could help dairy producers meet their methane goals. And an example of it is humming along just 3 miles away from Arroso's farm in Pixley.
We receive manure from about 1,700 cows, and it enters in this corner right here.
That's Sarah Gonzalez, a compliance officer at Calgren Renewable Fuels, and she's talking about an anaerobic digester. It's a facility that takes in a lot of manure.
We receive about 70,000 gallons a day.
And processes it in a way that recovers most of the methane and creates products like fuel and electricity.
So nothing gets wasted here. Nothing gets put in a dumpster or in a landfill.
Anaerobic digestion is a technology that can dramatically reduce emissions and potentially even bring in profit. Digesters reduce the need for manure lagoons that smell and release tons of greenhouse gases like methane. California is even offering subsidies to help build them. So, together with recent legislation, you might think it's a field day for digester operators and builders like Lyle Schleyer. He's the president of Calgren Renewable Fuels, the company that operates the Pixley Digester.
I think for us, it's a great opportunity. And we intend to try to take advantage of that.
Digesters are common in Europe. Germany alone has over 6,000. And yet, due to a host of regulatory, permitting, and economic challenges, California only has 15.
California has, in our view, ideal circumstances for digesters, and it has so few.
So this is it.
Gonzalez takes me on a tour of Calgren's anaerobic digester. It does indoors what manure lagoons do out in the elements. They allow the manure to decompose, and they recover most of the liquid solids and gases that are produced. They look like almost any other industrial building, usually tall, round, with a dome or cone-shaped roof, and with lots of twisting, turning pipes. Gonzalez says those 70,000 gallons of manure a day come from a neighboring dairy, and they spend about 21 days inside the digester.
And as it goes through this 21-day cycle, the manure and the bacteria, they create gas, and the gas is then funneled out through this pipe up here.
The water that's extracted can be cleaned enough to be used again for irrigation. Solids can be filtered out into a fibrous material to be used as bedding for cattle. It's brown and mossy looking. Gonzalez rubs some between her fingers.
You can touch it with your bare hands. Because it's been heated and sterilized, there's nothing left in it that has any bacteria. Yeah, it's been pasteurized. You would want to wash your hands afterwards. It might have a little bit of a smell to it still.
But the most economical byproduct is the methane. Operators can use it to create electricity to sell back to the grid, or they can refine it and inject it into natural gas pipelines that run through the state. Sounds like a win-win. Produce milk and save on manure and methane. But the environmental permitting process can be grueling. Calgren officials tell me it took the state almost 5 years to greenlight their digester. But the underlying problem for digesters appears to be economics. These facilities are expensive. They run at least a few million dollars. The state offers building subsidies, though many claim they're not enough. Then there's the price that utilities pay for the electricity from digesters. On principle, utilities want to pay as little as possible so they can charge ratepayers as little as possible. So the cheapest energy sources, like natural gas and wind, drive the cost of electricity down. Sean Hurley is an agricultural production economist at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo.
And so what's happening is that for a producer to do a digester, it's not necessarily anywhere close to the cheapest way of producing electricity. From the standpoint of trying to compete against a dam or a nuclear facility for just the cost of production per kilowatt hour, it can be a challenge.
Many blame low milk prices. California's producers are paid some of the lowest rates for milk in the country. So could raising those prices help offset the costs of digesters? Hurley says, not necessarily.
I think it would open up a lot of worms in the market. So what happens? You raise prices, people get more profitable. Then what do? They increase the number of cows that they have, which drive the prices down.
Now, there's one factor we haven't considered here, the consumer. Hurley suggests just like some shoppers pay more for organic milk, maybe they would do the same for milk that was associated with a digester.
The consumer is king, and the producers typically are going to give the consumer what they want.
So maybe when it comes to climate change and the future of agriculture, we're all in this together. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
Homelessness is a big problem throughout the valley. It's not just in large cities like Bakersfield and Fresno, though. Smaller towns and rural counties are facing their own challenges in serving those in need with food, shelter, and often mental health and substance abuse treatment. But what happens when finding a place to do all those things runs into community opposition? That's just what happened this month in Merced. After a week of being shut down for lack of a home, a popular program that serves food to those in need is finally back in operation, generating a controversy that's raising some interesting questions about what happens when the need is great and growing and almost everyone wants to help, just not next door. Since 1991, the Merced County Rescue Mission has been providing shelter, services, and ministry to the homeless in a leafy neighborhood just a couple blocks off Main Street. Bruce Metcalf runs the program.
The Merced County Rescue Mission serves about 150,000 meals every year, and we serve meals three times a day, 7 days a week. And we provide meals for people who are hungry, homeless people off the street, as well as we take meals out to other locations. And we also provide meals for our recovery programs and for families who are homeless.
You might remember Merced as the home to the newest campus of the University of California system, a ray of hope not just for this town, but for the entire San Joaquin Valley. Merced, though, was also one of the communities hit hardest by the housing crisis and the Great Recession, challenges the city is only now starting to emerge from. The latest official tally shows there are more than 500 homeless people in the county, many without shelter. That number has dropped in recent years, but Metcalf says the 15-bed shelter has seen demand grow. The Hot Meals program alone has increased 10 to 20% in recent years. But according to some people in the community, that growth has brought with it both problems and conflict. And on October 1st, the Walk Up Hot Meals program itself became homeless.
We are moving the meals from our present location for people who are homeless off the street because some of our neighbors are uncomfortable with the people who come for meals. And so we are trying to be good neighbors and are moving to another location.
And being a good neighbor can sometimes be a challenge, especially when you serve one of the most vulnerable populations in the community. Finding a new location can be even more difficult. And without a new site, Metcalf says he had no choice but to shut the program down, at least temporarily.
Before we quit serving, we gave people lists of places where they can get breakfast and lunch every day. And the only meal that there is not a place to get meals is the evening, the dinner meal. And so that's why we're anxious to get started again.
So what about the complaints from the community that Metcalf mentioned? One of the neighbors is right across the street, the Central Presbyterian Church. Ken Robbins is an elder there. He says his church has long been a supporter of the rescue mission. The church, he says, essentially owns the building the mission occupies.
They stay there for a dollar. We contribute significantly to their mission budget. Several of our people serve on their boards of directors, and we have been neighbors and missionaries in the downtown area of Merced together for a couple of decades. So we have an excellent relationship.
But while the church, he says, is supportive of the mission's ministry and shelter work, the Hot Meals program has brought with it problems.
The piece of the program that began to become a problem was not that they don't make meals there. They make meals, but what was happening is a lot of the folks who were not members of the discipleship program at the rescue mission, they were feeding. They were handing meals out, a couple of meals a day to folks who would come and gather there and then leave. And that program grew to the point where it began to have issues with other uses of the property.
He says as more and more people began to use the services, some had interactions with members of his church that weren't neighborly.
They would interface with kids or folks in the evening, or they would not be discreet where they used the restroom facilities. That all happened out in the streets and then the sidewalks.
He says the church tried to work with the mission to fix the situation, but things didn't improve.
For instance, there have been a couple of occasions where public nudity has occurred there, not in malicious ways, but with people sort of out in the alley changing clothes and whatnot while children were in the vicinity. Or we find human waste on steps or in elevators, it isn't necessarily these are bad people. There just aren't the kinds of total facilities available to service all those needs all in that same place.
For his part, Metcalf admits there have been problems and is blunt when he describes the situation.
Some of the people that attend there with their young children are simply uncomfortable with some of the guests that we serve.
The issue came to a head earlier this summer when the church leadership and rescue mission staff sat down in search of a solution. The idea was to find a new home and move the Hot Meals program out of the Canal Street location by October 1st, while other programs like the shelter would stay behind.
It wasn't our idea to close the facility, but rather to make it mobile, to try to relieve some of the problems that occurred with multiple uses of the whole property.
The church would have provided two vehicles to help make it happen, but Metcalf says the rescue mission itself doesn't want to go mobile.
That's Ken's idea. That is not the mission's idea. And we are not going to do that. The city does not want us to be serving meals under bridges and in public parks, because that simply exacerbates the problem of homeless people being in areas where it's not appropriate.
Then as the October 1st deadline approached, it looked like the mission had finally found a site. A lot downtown that was affiliated with another faith-based group could have been a temporary feeding location, but it too met with opposition, this time from business groups.
There was some concern about people in the area wouldn't be happy with that location either. And that was really a temporary place so that we could not miss serving at all, or miss just maybe a few days.
It seemed that no one in Merced wanted to be neighbors with the people the Hot Meals program serves. Finally, though, a bit of good news. On Monday night, after being shuttered for over a week, the mission was again serving hot dinners to hundreds of people, only this time with a new congregation in a new home, the Cavalry Temple Assembly of God Church at 10th and R Streets, just on the other side of Highway 99. Bruce Metcalf is more than relieved.
They have a food ministry giving food boxes to people who are low income, and they were very excited about the possibility of expanding that to help people. And so we're able to use their facilities and serve people inside a wonderful room with restrooms and so we're just cooperating with them, and we will do all of the meal service, and we're excited about being able to do this together.
Metcalf says he's still working with the city and county to find a permanent campus that can house all of the mission's activities, including the one still based at the old location. And there's one last twist to this story. Central Presbyterian Church is providing the mission with vehicles to transport workers and food to the new feeding location. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition. Sometimes in public policy, especially in healthcare, most everyone agrees there's an obvious problem. But more often than not, getting everyone to agree on a solution is much harder. That's what's happening right now when it comes to mental health care in the Central Valley. FM89's Jeffrey Hess reports on how two mental health facilities in Fresno County are meeting very different community reactions.
First, let's get the thing everyone agrees on out of the way. It's probably not a surprise that the Central Valley has a severe shortage of mental health facilities and providers. Combined with high rates of mental illness, access to care is a major concern.
They're generally scarce everywhere, but in particular in this county, new programs and services, I think, are desperately needed. So that's why we identified this area.
That's Michael Zahner, the Group Director of Behavioral Health with Universal Health Systems. Zahner is interested in building a big new behavioral health facility in Clovis. They're proposing building a 102-bed, $40 million short-term inpatient care hospital near Highway 168 and Clovis Avenue. The company has a lot of experience with this kind of hospital. They run more than 200 mental health facilities around the world. Zahner says the location would mean the hospital is accessible to much of the county. But that has not sat well with some community members who oppose construction near their homes.
And I am a not-in-my-backyard kind of a person. And there's lots of things I would say not in my backyard, too. There's lots of things I approve of that I don't want in my backyard.
Randall Gray is a Clovis resident helping lead the charge against the facility. He agrees there's no question that the facility is badly needed, just not where the company wants to build it. He worries it's being built too close to homes, schools, and could endanger children.
You're going to have people that are being released by taxi, that are driving places that might want to get out of the taxi. There's going to be people. Here's one of my big fears. You're going to have people that are homeless. You know, if a hospital can't handle them and the police can't handle them, they're going to send them there.
Gray also argues that building the facility at its current location would tank property values. He thinks it should be built in a more remote location. Michael Zahner with United Health Systems says they've run into this kind of skepticism before, but have not seen the negative results Gray expects.
All I can say is what actually happens in terms of safety, homelessness, increase in crime, land value impact. We just haven't seen that. It hasn't borne itself out. So I guess, yes, I can understand it. I just think it's misplaced or misguided.
At the same time, the Fresno County Department of Behavioral Health is in the process of constructing a 16-bed medium to long-term psychiatric care facility at the corner of Huntington Boulevard and Barton Avenue near the University Medical Center campus. Dewan Utecht is the department's director.
So this would be for people who don't meet the requirements to be in an inpatient setting, but still need some supports and a place to stay until they can stabilize.
Consider someone who's homeless and needs a safe place to stay until they can fully reintegrate. The plan now is to let people stay for about a month. UTEC says that is something that is currently lacking in what she calls the county's continuum of care. Currently, the county has fewer than 100 crisis stabilization beds for people who need intensive intervention, a number that UTEC says most people would consider underbedded for a county of nearly 1 million people. As a result, she's fully supportive of Universal Health Systems adding 100 beds to the county's capacity. However, the 16-bed Southeast Fresno facility has not experienced the kind of pushback the proposed Clovis Hospital is seeing. UTEC thinks that might be because the county owned the land already and did not need the kind of use permit the hospital in Clovis needs. Still, she finds community concerns about mental health patients troubling.
The more we create this stigma and discrimination around mental illness, the more chance people will not seek help, that they will hide their illness, because when they hide it or when they put it out in the open, this is the kind of response they get.
The hospital the county is building is expected to be open next year at a cost of around $5 million. The fate of the 102-bed hospital in Clovis is still in question. It received initial approval from the Clovis Planning Commission, but now must also be approved by the Clovis City Council. And some, like Randall Gray, promise to keep fighting it. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
This is Valley Edition. This year, Yosemite National Park is on pace to serve 4.5 million visitors. That would be an all-time record. All those people mean a lot of traffic in a place known for its serenity. And as FM 89's Ezra David Romero reports, the Park Service is in the process of making changes so visitors won't have to wait in what often feels like rush hour traffic in the middle of the forest.
I'm annoyed. I've circled Yosemite Valley for about an hour now, and as I look out my car window, it's as if Half Dome is taunting me. In 5 minutes, I need to be in an interview with a park ranger. It's back-to-back traffic, and I just want a parking spot. This is the plight of almost anyone that chooses to visit Yosemite Valley these days. It's not even a weekend. It's a Tuesday in September. Finally, the train of cars moves forward, and I see a single parking spot. I take it and run to my interview. I'm not the only one bothered by this. Russ and Lori Albert just drove in from Utah. It's their first time to the park.
Things aren't very well marked so that you know where you need to go. And I mean, yeah, with parking, you don't know. You know, oh, day use. Is that where I'm supposed to go if I want to go to the visitor center and not day hike or backpack? So we don't really want to come back. We don't know if it's worth all of this. It's pretty crazy.
Traffic in the park is especially bad today because construction crews are tearing up a parking lot. The lot was too close to the Merced River. This creates a buffer zone between the two. The construction has temporarily changed the traffic pattern in the park from one-way to two-way streets in different spots. It's all part of the Merced River plan with a goal of protecting and restoring the river to its former glory. Yosemite National Park spokesman Scott Gedeman says this is all about creating a better sense of arrival for visitors.
The whole parking and orientation is certainly important, but we don't want that to be an ordeal. We want people to drive in, get out of their cars, hike on the trails, walk, enjoy the scenery.
The parking lot they're removing is known as Camp 6, near the main store in Yosemite Valley. Frequent visitors to the region know that the four-way stop right before the store can be a nightmare. A forever stream of people are moving across a crosswalk, and cars are lined up for about a half a mile in every direction. Gedeman says they hope to remedy this congestion with a roundabout.
Safety is a huge concern, so the whole idea of the roundabout was to basically make an area that's heavily used, make the wayfinding easier, and keep the traffic flowing.
I like the idea of a traffic circle, but it doesn't ease my annoyance over the lack of parking here. Gedeman says this parking lot will end up holding about the same amount of cars. The end goal is to reduce the footprint of the lot by restoring 1.2 acres of wetland. Another parking lot will be revamped near Yosemite Lodge next year. But at some point, are there just too many cars coming in?
Basically, we just have to wait and see. It's been a really busy year, but the point being is that we feel that we can continue to accommodate the number of visitors that we're getting.
Gedeman says the parking lot will open sometime this winter. New pedestrian pathways and another shuttle stop will be constructed as well. Improvements to other lots like the Yosemite Falls parking area will start in 2017. Even still, park visitors like Lori and Russ Albert from Utah are questioning whether a second trip to Yosemite is worth it. They also couldn't find a campsite.
We had a pretty rough day yesterday. We're going to try and backpack overnight on North Dome, and we ended up hiking like 15 miles, so that wasn't a good day.
No.
And just, you know, the traffic's probably been the worst thing about today, I'd say, you know, but the views have been spectacular. It's been pretty surreal.
And as the Park Service figures out how to preserve this mountain valley for future generations, it brings the question up again of how many visitors can the park really handle. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
A few weeks ago on this program, we launched a new standalone podcast, which we call Outdoorsy. It's all about the great things that you can do outdoors in the Central California landscape. In our first episode, we brought you to Sequoia National Park's Mineral King Valley.
This time, our outdoorsy team of Ezra David Romero and Carrie Klein take us up over Kaiser Pass into a place called Mono Hot Springs.
It just restores you. It makes you feel better about people and the world itself.
Hey, everybody. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Ezra David Romero. This is Outdoorsy, a new podcast from Valley Public Radio.
We take you to wild places in Central California and introduce you to the people who explore them.
In our last episode, we took you to this mountain oasis called Mineral King in Sequoia National Park. This time, we go 100 miles north of there to a place called Mono Hot Springs.
It's a cluster of hot pools and baths in a mountain valley just next to a fork in the San Joaquin River. It's tucked away in the Sierra south of Mammoth Lakes and Yosemite, and it's about halfway from the valley to the east side.
Like Mineral King, it's at the end of a long, winding road. To get there from Fresno, you drive up Highway 168 east, past places like Shaver Lake and China Peak Ski Resort. Before you reach Huntington Lake, you turn onto Kaiser Pass Road, which quickly turns into a one-lane mountain road.
At some points, it's worse than the road to Mineral King. It's narrow and bumpy, and at a few points, the side of the road drops off literally in a cliff. We don't recommend driving it at night.
Also, because it's really pretty. As you climb the pass, you briefly venture out of a dense pine forest onto rocky mountain terrain, then settle back underneath ponderosa and lodgepole pines for the rest of the drive. Once you've made it, you arrive at a mini community of campgrounds, cabins, and a restaurant, and even a general store. It's charming and rustic and has something for everybody.
In this episode, we'll take you there and talk about all the other great things you can do nearby. We'll also talk about a kind of off-the-beaten-path camping that's not quite backpacking, but it's definitely not a campground.
We'll finish with some camp food stories. Who doesn't like food?
So let's start at the hot springs themselves. Ezra and I have both spent time there, but we decided this week to bring in someone else to tell you about it. Alice Daniel is a reporter for KQED, and like us, she's based here in Fresno. Hey, Alice.
Hello.
So you recently reported a piece about Mono for KQED as part of a series called Hidden Places. What drew you there in the first place?
I had been there before, and I think what drew me there was I knew I was going to take my kids, and I knew there were a lot of snakes there. Doris Lake is filled with snakes, so I figured what better place to take two boys than a place that's filled with snakes.
And where's Doris Lake?
So Doris Lake is about a mile from the hot springs. It's an easy hike for kids.
And so snakes are a positive for you rather than a negative?
Yes, very much so. Well, you'll hear in my story that actually snakes aren't positive for everybody, but I think they liked it.
They're interesting nonetheless.
Yeah.
Let's listen to this story.
The road to Mono Hot Springs is narrow, winding, essentially one lane, even though cars go both ways. Potholes and bumps cause my car to bottom out. Fortunately, I have two adolescent backseat drivers, and one of them is hanging out the window.
What are you doing? Well, I was going to look out of the car to see if there was gas leaking out of
that's
it.
That's really smart.
That's you.
My sons, Atticus and Asher, they're 14 and 12. It takes an hour to go 17 miles. Before this road was built in 1927 with dynamite and power jackhammers, pack horses and mules would take visitors over Kaiser Pass, sometimes guided by Mono Indians. The 1930s were the heyday for enthusiastic soakers.
People loved hot springs. That was kind of the golden years.
That's Jeff Winslow. He runs the historic Mono Hot Springs Resort. It's an easygoing, rustic place with stone cabins and a bathhouse where spring water is piped into private tubs. There's no sulfur smell, and the water is a perfect 101 degrees. A few years before the resort opened, the Depression-era Civilian Conservation Corps built a campground here, as well as concrete baths to hold in the spring water. Older Japanese-American farmers from the Central Valley would spend months here.
In fact, there were so many people here, mostly Japanese, that they just took over the whole campground.
Some of these concrete tubs still exist. The trail to them in a meadow along the San Joaquin River is mucky in parts, kind of grabs you like wet clay. Some crazy people, like my kids, jump in the ice-cold, leg-numbing Sierra snow melt. Before hightailing it up the riverbank to plunge in a hot pool.
Oh,
Well, not to me. It feels pretty good, although the water's really dark and kind of slimy. But there's more to this area than soaking. Rugged wilderness all around. Alpine lakes framed by steep granite cliffs. One of them, Doris Lake, is a great swimming spot. But we've been told this place is slithering with snakes.
I don't think I'll get all the way in.
Why?
I can't see the bottom and it's filled with snakes.
We've only seen one snake in.
Where there's one, there's more. If I could see the bottom, I'd be okay with it.
You can see the bottom.
Finally, the kids get in and try to catch fish with their hands.
I think that fish are pretty elusive.
What's that mean?
Hard to catch.
No fish in hand, we head back for one last dip in one of the natural mineral pools. For the California Report, I'm Alice Daniel in Mono Hot Springs.
There's algae on the bottom. It tickles.
So, Alice, you start out the piece talking about the long road to get there. And so when I drove up, I remember it was nighttime. It was bumpy. I wasn't driving, luckily, but I didn't see a whole lot of the surroundings. So what was your experience there? And what did I miss by driving up here at night?
You missed a lot of extremely stunning scenery. But the problem is you're on this road that's listed as one of America's most dangerous. One thing you want to watch out for are the blind curves, because there's barely room for two cars. You want to be careful because there's usually a car coming in the other direction, and you usually have to back up a little bit, and there's a cliff on one side. So it's a little nerve-wracking. You don't want to just be staring at the scenery.
Can you tell some of the history of that road?
So the road was built in the 1920s, and it was built for this huge hydroelectric project called the Big Creek Project. And apparently the last 6 or 7 miles of the road were so difficult to build that it was dubbed the cheap and nasty. They blew it up with dynamite. They had to remove huge boulders as big as houses. And yes, there is asphalt on the road, but, you know, it's kind of falling apart in some places.
We heard in the piece your car bottomed out once or something like
that.
Yeah,
several times.
Yeah. My little Prius did the same thing on the way up there.
Yeah.
So then once you actually get to Mono Hot Springs, you mentioned a few baths walled in with cement, but there's a lot more there, right? Paint us a picture of what the area looks like and what's there.
Right. So Mono Hot Springs is in a valley, and you drive down into it, and it's just this sort of beautiful meadow area. And you've got the walled in concrete tubs, and there's probably 4 or 5 of those. But there's also some very natural hot springs all around the valley. So you kind of just have to walk and explore, and you can find them. Some are more hidden than others. But they're lovely little gems because you're just sitting there in the middle of this pool of hot water, and oftentimes you're the only one there.
Yeah, and then, of course, getting to the springs itself is a little bit of an adventure, too.
It's pretty funny, the mucky dirt. Well, I'm thinking about walking to the hot springs. It's almost like quicksand sometimes when you're walking through all that muck. And it's kind of funny, when I was walking along, I noticed there would be just like one sole flip-flop on the trail. Like somebody just couldn't quite get it out. And one of my kids actually got one of his flip-flops stuck in the muck. But I made him go back and dig it out, because it just seems disgusting to leave a flip-flop in the middle of this wilderness.
Yeah, and of course, you're here with your kids. I mean, I think a lot of folks find bringing children along into the wilderness difficult, or at least intimidating. Is it always easy for you to find spots your whole family can enjoy?
What I find is that adults think of going outdoors as a destination, and they think of hikes as something you have to finish. But with kids, they're just in the moment. So if you take them on a hike, just make sure they can stop and climb boulders and play in creeks, because they don't care about the end result. They're not on a hike to get to the top. They're on a hike because they want to see what's going on around them.
And then, of course, there's where to stay. There's this whole resort area. There are cabins, campgrounds, lots of campsites up and down Keyser Pass Road. Where did you stay when you were there, and what was your experience?
So we stayed at Mono Hot Springs in one of the cabins, and the cabins are very rustic. The one we stayed in was just one room with a light bulb hanging from the ceiling. They have fire pits outside if they don't have kitchens inside. Some of them do have kitchens. So you can cook outside. We ate one night in the restaurant, and the restaurant is kind of famous for having interesting food like corned buffalo and buffalo ribs and elk burgers, so kind of hearty, rustic food. But we didn't eat any of that because we're vegetarian. there are also, if you don't want to just do the outdoor hot springs and you want more privacy, you can go to the bathhouse at the resort where they have individual rooms with tubs in them. So you can take a bath in an individual room. And they also have an outdoor spa. So that's nice. And the water's cleaner.
Did you guys do that?
We did. We did everything.
Everything.
We soaked a lot.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Right. And so I feel like we should mention, we've talked a lot about the drawbacks to this place, the dangerous road, the muck, the snakes. But this place is really so much more than that, right?
You know, it's just such a stunningly beautiful place that it's not negative at all. Those are just kind of funny things that happen and sort of make you appreciate the effort it takes to get there. You get into the hot springs and it is just, I think it's just heavenly. It's such a beautiful place and it just restores you. It makes you feel better about people and the world itself.
Yeah, when I went up there, it seemed like up there everyone came together.
Everyone's happy up there.
Yeah, people share a hot spring together. They don't know each other.
Right.
And you're kind of forced to talk to people. Was that your experience?
Exactly. Yes. Yes. You do have to talk to people. If you're sitting in the hot springs with them, you'd feel kind of funny if you didn't say hello.
They're very tight quarters. Some of them are very small. And so do you have any advice for someone who's going there for the first time, what they should aim to do or see or experience to have the best time?
You know, I think a person going to Mono Hot Springs doesn't need advice because all you have to do is sit in one of those delightful tubs or natural hot springs and you've made it. You're there.
All right. Well, thanks, Alice.
Thanks, Alice.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
There's a lot more to do than just basking in hot water in the Mono Hot Springs area. When I went up there this summer, I went kayaking on Edison Lake near the Pacific Crest Trail.
In this past September, my friends and I hiked to Doris Lake, just like Alice did, and we stayed at a gorgeous campsite on a bend in the river.
My friends and I also camped, but we stayed off the grid. That's called dispersed camping. To find out more about this way to camp, I want you to meet Jeff Green. By day, he runs media inquiries for Riverside County in Southern California. But his true passion is the outdoors. He writes about his escapades on a blog called Green Adventures. He and his school buddies have camped in this area every summer for the past 16 years.
I describe that area as having 80% of the scenery of Kings Canyon and Yosemite and 1% of the people. It really is about how beautiful that area is and yet so isolated. The little one-lane road that you got to drive on for an hour to get back there really keeps crowds down. It's mostly people who are serious about the outdoors.
When Green and his buds go to Mono, they want to camp alone. They try not to stay in designated campgrounds.
We prefer being able to camp by ourselves, bring all of our own gear, all of our own equipment, and not have to deal with neighbors or have neighbors have to deal with us. There's a lot of areas back there for what they call dispersed camping, which is camping somewhere other than in a campground. And it's perfectly legal in the national forest. If you want to have a campfire, you have to get a fire permit.
A fire permit can be picked up at the High Sierra Ranger District Station in the mountain town of Prather on the way up the hill.
There's also the High Sierra Visitor Information Station. You can't miss it. It's the only building for miles on Kaiser Pass Road.
Green says the most important part of dispersed camping is that, like backpacking, you need to bring everything.
You just have to be completely self-reliant. Besides your regular camping gear, you need to bring your own portable toilet. You need to bring all your own water. A lot of people for dispersed camping, it's backpack style, and they'll pack in their stuff and pack out their stuff. But we tend to like to eat really, really well, and we tend to like to drink really, really well. So we have way too much gear to slap on our backs, but in a couple of trucks, we can bring in everything we need.
People love to hike, fish, and kayak on lakes and rivers here. Both the Pacific Crest Trail and the John Muir Trail run nearby.
One cool feature a few miles east of Mono Hot Springs is Edison Lake. There's a ferry that brings hikers across the reservoir to a camp store and hot showers at a place called Vermilion Valley Resort. And if you don't like to hike that much, you can also bring guns and hunt or target practice.
One of the reasons we like the dispersed camp is because we can actually shoot right in the middle of our campsite. We can put up little targets, and while we're waiting for dinner to be done, we can just target shoot right there on the site. So you know, and again, you would never be able to do that if you're in a campground. Camp hosts get a little agitated when you try to do something like that.
Yeah, totally.
So you've had an amazing day soaking in hot tubs, hiking, swimming, maybe soaking again, and you settle back into your campsite for the evening. Your campfire's roaring.
Check.
Drinking a cold beer.
Check.
Now, what do you eat?
Being out of the kitchen scares a lot of people, but camp cooking doesn't have to be difficult.
Or terrifying. For me, I like to take prepackaged foods like ramen or macaroni and cheese and add tons of fresh veggies to them.
I don't like that. I like to bring tons of snacks. I like to have sandwiches and chips for lunch and some heartier meals like homemade chili, baked potatoes, or steaks for dinner. Things that you can cook on the open fire.
But you hear from us all the time. So what about you? We put out a call on Facebook for camp cooking and got back some great tips and pointers. Here's Molly in Fresno.
Recently, I went to Tasmania, and along with the three prepackaged meals that I purchased, I brought along a cheese, some bread, a small plastic baggie of jam, and a sausage that was hard enough to sustain not being refrigerated. At the end of day three, I was more thankful to have a broiled grilled cheese sandwich than I had been at any other point in the trip, just based on the fact that those flavors reminded me of home in a foreign place.
And here's Jill from Wisconsin.
If you're doing a long trip, go out on a one overnight or two night shakedown trip and try eating it on the trail. My appetite changes so much on the trail, and normal things that I would eat are disgusting. The things that I do want to eat are different. In fact, I just tried eating my favorite backpacking meal out of the context of backpacking, and it's not that good. So try it on the trail.
And then, of course, there's only one way to end the evening. Here's Emily in L.A.
When I think of camping, I think of family and sitting around the fireplace, and for me, that always meant s'mores. So it doesn't matter where I'm camping or with who, I always make sure that I bring stuff to make s'mores. I think it's delicious, but on top of that, it's just this warm sense of friendship and everyone being around the fire and being together. And I love that. And that, to me, is the best part of camping.
Check out our website for a favorite recipe from me and Ezra.
Like what you've heard? Want to get your story on our show? Follow Valley Public Radio on Facebook and keep an eye out for posts about Outdoorsy. We're also on Twitter and Instagram. Our username is OutdoorsyPod for both.
And that's today's show. Our editor is Joe Moore, and we had engineering help from Don Weaver.
Our music is by Kevin McLeod and Ben Sound.
Stay tuned for future shows when we visit other wild places and interview the people who love them. For Outdoorsy, I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Ezra David Romero. Thanks for listening.
See ya.
Bye.
This is Valley Edition. Music is filling concert halls throughout Central California this month as classical symphony orchestras are active all throughout the valley. A few weeks ago, we told you about the Fresno Philharmonic's new season. Last week, it was conductor Stillian Kirov of the Bakersfield Symphony who joined us. Right now, we have on the phone Bruce Kiesling with the Tulare County Symphony presenting a concert this weekend. Bruce, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be with you today.
I want to talk about your concert titled Billy the Kid, American Identities, and what's coming up this weekend in just a moment. But first, I want to start out. You have a new feature to your orchestra, or at least to the theater this year. You have a new shell. Why is that important? Because I guess to the audience, they see what's the backdrop behind the orchestra. Why would that matter for the musicians and the audience experience?
Well, when we talk about an orchestra shell, what we're really talking about is that architectural item that sort of wraps around the orchestra, the sides, the back behind the orchestra, and very importantly, the pieces of acoustical treatment that are above the orchestra. And if for us, for the past 8 years that I've been here at least, there's been sort of a makeshift piece that we had a couple of different elements that moved around, but they weren't quite enough to really encase the entire orchestra in sound, and certainly our biggest thing that was missing was acoustical treatment above the orchestra. And so we have recently, we completed fundraising for a large purchase of a new orchestral shell that has an adequate number of pieces to wrap the full sides and the rear of the orchestra, as well as acoustical treatment above, which are called clouds, with lights in them so that the musicians are seen and they can see their music. And what that basically does is it captures the sound, and it does kick it out into the hall in a much more complete and balanced way. And then the other thing that you just mentioned that's a really important piece is it allows the orchestra not only to hear themselves a little bit better, but to hear the different sections of the orchestra. So if you're sitting on one end of the orchestra, you know, there are 80 people on stage. Who is furthest from you may be a good ways away. And in the old treatment, without that, especially the pieces above the orchestra, without that, it was very difficult to hear across the orchestra. So in this one case, which was so fantastic, we had our first rehearsal last night in our new acoustic environment, and many of the musicians were like blown away, but they're like, wow, I can hear sections of the orchestra that I've not heard before. So not only will our audience benefit from what we know will be a much more complete and balanced and beautiful orchestral experience, but the orchestra already has started to enjoy the benefits of that. So it's a big thing for us and something we've been talking about and raising money for several seasons. So it's a real feather in the cap of the institution, the theater that we share our space with, and for our audience as well.
It's the first chance for the public to hear what that sounds like at the historic Fox Theater this weekend, October 15th. The concert is called American Identities. It sandwiches a new work by composer and instrumentalist Edgar Meyer, his violin concerto, with two very well-known pieces by Aaron Copland. I want to talk about Edgar Meyer in a moment, but let's start out with Copland. His music is so identified with America, the American West. Why is that? Was it that Copland captured something there, or is it that pop culture has so embraced his music that it has now become synonymous? Many classical composers drew on folk themes and things. Is that what Copland was doing there?
I think definitely. When he was writing, you know, he really was looking for a distinctly American sound, and he experimented. He was born in 1900, so certainly that time in America, there was a lot of experimentation musically and looking for an identity, and he dabbled in jazz, he dabbled in new music, and then in the 1930s and 40s, he really settled into sort of an American popularism, and he researched cowboy songs for his ballets, Appalachian Spring, Billy the Kid, and Rodeo. Those things, he, you know, did a lot of research into traditional cowboy songs, etc., and that, I think, he toyed with that. That was another experiment for him in a way, and a phase for him, but it captured the public's imagination, as you say, in a way that made those his most popular works, and certainly they're the works that continue to be played today, and he himself became a film scorer, so I often think that one of the reasons we think that is because so many film scores that came during that time and after him sort of hark back to his, that old, the sound of the great plains, the old West, all of that comes so much from Copland's influence. And I think that was partially because he was in Hollywood for part of that time, writing film scores for a few things, not particularly Westerns, but certainly he knew some of those people that ran around in those circles. You know, he was born in New York City, never really traveled to the American West too much, and studied in Paris for part of that time. So it's not exactly a musical Western pedigree, to say the least. But there's something about his music not only resonated for audiences, but I think for him as a composer that allowed him to use those folk songs, those folk elements, and really suggest this idea of the great American dream, the American West, and even Manifest Destiny, which I think is all part of the American optimism that is in his music.
And then you talk about a versatile musician, a versatile composer, Edgar Meyer, a great double bassist, who's at home performing traditional folk songs or Bach or with the symphony orchestra. He has a violin concerto, and you have an extraordinary violinist, Alexei Kenny, performing that work with your orchestra. What is it about that piece that most intrigues you?
Well, I love that it really fits into our program because we're talking about American identities. And as you mentioned, the composer Edgar Meyer, he really does a little bit of everything. And I think he captures those different elements in his concerto. This piece was commissioned by Hilary Hahn and has only been played by a few orchestras. It's a rather new piece out there, and we're thrilled to be presenting it with such a fantastic soloist with Alexei. And it's kind of a piece that has lots of different American influences. There are moments of minimalism that sound like John Adams. And then particularly in the second movement, which is really two different themes combined, you hear this influence of that sort of American traditional music folk song that comes in the second movement. And you can really hear that part of the music that speaks to Edgar Meyer's, that part of his career. And the way he works it in a very contemporary sound and setting, it still sounds distinctly American and really fits right in. Our whole season with the Tulare County Symphony this year is called Back to Our Roots. So the whole year we're experimenting and sharing music that was inspired by different kinds of folk idioms, folk songs, gypsy songs, and traditional music. So whether we're hearing music of Beethoven, Tchaikovsky, or in this case, Copland, we're really trying to find examples of composers who were inspired by those same kind of things, that folk tradition, and certainly not only Copland, but Edgar Meyer in this piece is another example of that.
You have another concert coming up in November, a Stellar Serenades, of course, Tchaikovsky's famous violin concerto, and then the suite from Stravinsky's The Firebird. How does that fit into this season?
Well, certainly the violin concerto, that famous third movement of the violin concerto, was based on a traditional Cossack folk song. So that we'll have that again in our January program, where both Beethoven and Tchaikovsky symphonies that were inspired by fiddle playing come in. And then in Stravinsky's piece as well, those the song that comes in at the end of The Firebird Dance has really become almost its own traditional song. So that famous tune that comes in during their Bursusen finale, the lullaby, and the last piece that comes in, we think of that as something that's become part of the popular culture today.
Again, Bruce Kiesling with us today on Valley Public Radio. You mentioned a concert featuring Beethoven and Tchaikovsky in 2017. Tell us about that as well.
Yes, in January 14th, it's called Indigenous Impressions, because in that program we'll have, again, music by Beethoven, his first symphony, and Tchaikovsky's second symphony, which is called The Little Russian, and we call it The Little Russian Symphony because it's all based on Ukrainian folk songs, and at that time, the Ukraine was known as Little Russia, and so he subtitled this symphony, the Little Russian Symphony, because each of the movements is inspired by folk songs and actually quotes them. And again, very much in that fiddle tradition of fast playing in the violins in both the last movement of the Beethoven and throughout that Tchaikovsky. And looking ahead, we have an incredible jazz program. In February, we will be doing some wonderful music by George Gershwin, with his Rhapsody in Blue. Again, something's become part of the culture, part of our musical vernacular in this country. And then we continue with, of course, our most popular concert, which is our Great Movies, Great Music. We do this every year. And so we'll have a little bit of everything. This year's program, we're celebrating Oscars. So different music and scores from films that have won, or in a couple of cases just were nominated but didn't actually win the Oscar. And then we close the season, kind of bookending this first concert with music of Aaron Copland with his fantastic Symphony No. 3.
We're looking forward to it, and maybe those Academy voters should have got it right the first time on some of those.
Absolutely.
But we'll look forward to the Hollywood concert and all of those that are coming up at the Visalia Fox Theater with the Tulare County Symphony. Bruce Kiesling, the director and conductor, joining us today. You can find more information online at TulareCountySymphony.com. The concert is this Saturday at the Fox, again featuring music by Aaron Copland and Edgar Meyer. Bruce, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can send us an email, talk@kvpr.org. You can also send us a tweet. We are at KVPR and at Valley Edition. Also, at Outdoorsy on Twitter. Actually, Outdoorsy Pod on Twitter and Outdoorsy on Instagram. And find our podcast on iTunes by searching Outdoorsy there as well. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Carrie Klein and Jeffrey Hess, Audio engineer Marv Allen and production operations manager Don Weaver. I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.